One of the most stunning new pieces of climate fiction is from Lydia Yuknovich. It's a speculative novel called The Book of Joan, set in a disturbingly near future. Earth is decimated. Radiation exposure has altered the bodies of the few survivors who orbit our husk of a planet on a hacked-together spaceship. Steve Paulson recently got together with Lydia Yuknovich to talk about some of the ideas in the book and also to see if she still has any faith in humanity's future.
Through the wall-sized window, I can see a distant nebula. Its gases and hypnotic hues make me hold my breath. I can also see the dying ball of dirt, Earth, circa 2049, our former home. It looks smudged in sepia. A fern perched in the window catches my eye. Well, what used to be a fern? I never had a green thumb, even those long years ago when I lived on Earth. This fern is mostly a sad little curve of stick. Its photosynthesis is entirely artificial. If it were allowed the sun we've got now, with the absence of adequate ozone layers, it would instantly die. Rats in a maze, we are. Far enough from the sun to exist in inhabitable zones, and yet so close, one wrong move, and we're incinerated. We're the aftermath of Earth life.
So, Lydia, you have conjured up a rather grim picture of our planet in the near future, around the year 2049. The Earth's ecosystems have collapsed. What does this world look like?
The world looks like something easy to picture cinematically on one level. There's no blue sky and vegetation is gone and everything is sort of bleak and dry and dirt colored. So that's one way to talk about it. But another way to talk about this conjuring you mentioned is it's a future that I could throw a rock at. It's so close.
Now, that's interesting. So, I mean, this is not your vision of some far off, distant, horribly dystopian version of the future. You're saying we have one foot in this world already.
Absolutely. I'd even go as far as to argue that we need to reimagine what we mean by the word dystopia, because I think we've already made it, but we've been tricking ourselves with fictions that it rests in some distance away from us.
So there is a new kind of fiction that people are talking about now, what's been called cli-fi, climate fiction. Is this?
Yes, I love this phrase.
Is this your version?
It is my version, and I first kind of caught wind of it probably about 12 years ago. But I love the phrase because science fiction as a category and dystopian fiction and speculative fiction, they kind of lock the understanding of the story into this set of genres, you know, that are very traditional and follow certain plot points. But cli-fi kind of opened up the idea that the environment would no longer just be like the setting or the difficulty that the characters were going to confront, but that it might itself be more central as the main character. I just find that fascinating because I think we do need to redefine our relationship to the planet. And so this is a way to reimagine our relationship to the actual dirt.
Well, let's get back to this world that you have envisioned. There are a few human survivors who have left the planet. I mean, there are no people left on the planet, and they now hover out in space in some sort of giant spaceship, what's called CL.
Thing.
Thing. What is this?
Well, it's an attempt at survival. You know, it's a space station that was not constructed in the best of times, but in the worst of times. And so it's kind of patchwork. And so things don't quite work properly, and they're not as high-tech as they should be. And then the humans, as you say, who've ascended to this junk heap up in the sky, are themselves not what they used to be. And I was playing with the idea that everything has been orphaned and damaged and rearranged to the extent that we don't even really know who we are or why we are or what we're doing. And in the story, the people who are up there, they look different, they act different, they feel differently than we do.
You set this not that far into the future. I mean, 2049, and things have radically changed. I mean, why not set this 200 or 300 years into the future rather than, you know, a few decades?
Well, it's a great question. And I think in the tradition of sci-fi novels, that would be the normal plot trajectory. But I'm writing in a time where things like Trump happened in the blink of an eye. And regardless of anyone's attitude about this thing that's happened in America, it happened so quickly and with such speed, I think we failed to understand that speed is the primary factor of change in our lives right now. When I thought about the speed with which the things we're scared of could literally happen, because they are happening, I decided to shorten and cut that time span to remind ourselves that the future is alive in our present all the time.
Hmm. Now, the hero of your story is a young rebel named Joan. Some people would call her an eco-terrorist. And basically, you have reimagined the old story of Joan of Arc, that warrior woman from the 15th century who fought against the English, reported having visions of angels, was then captured and burned at the stake at the age of 19. Why does that story resonate for you?
Well, more than one reason. I was raised Catholic for the first part of my life, my early life, and it didn't work. I didn't make it even to 15 years old as a devout person or a Catholic person. But that's where I first encountered this storyline of this girl. And I was a kid when I first heard about it from my sister. And my first reaction was, what? There are girl warriors and no one's telling us? Where are they hiding them? And, you know, I mean, I had kid shock that I'd never heard of this person. And so I became obsessed immediately with her. And then when I was in my adolescence, she visited me in a dream.
Are you serious?
Completely serious. Wow. I'm also smiling because this is where I tend to lose people.
Tell me about that dream.
Well, I've had three epic dreams in my life where a historical figure has shown up. And I mean, like, showed up in your bedroom, standing next to your bed, talking to you.
Wow.
Like that real. She took me outside to stand in front of my house, and my house was on fire, symbolically. She said, no one's going to save you. And at the time, it just kind of creeped me out and... you know, interested me and scared me. But later in life, as I was, you know, a woman who went through enough misfortunes in her own coming of age that the idea that one might have to save oneself became kind of like a life mantra for me. So I had an obsession and fascination with her for those reasons. But then as I was wanting to write a story about climate change and war and love, just how important it is that we begin to redefine our relationships to the planet and to belief and to each other, she occurred to me as the perfect historical figure to dig back up and bring voice to.
Just as a tangent, I'm curious about who are the other two historical characters who figured in your dreams?
I'll tell you one of the other ones. Mary Shelley.
Okay.
My favorite novel of all time is Frankenstein. And so she showed up once. And
also at your bedside,
at
too?
At the bedside.
Wow.
She was wearing a dark green velvet dress. I can tell you what she smelled like. And she also said an important sentence to me. She said, motherhood is not monsterhood, which I've written about because eventually in my life, I had a daughter who died the day she was born. And so then that sentence took on a life that probably, it would not be an exaggeration to say that sentence helped save my life.
Wow. These dreams that you're talking about, I mean, they sound more real than, you know, waking life.
Yeah, I have regular dreams too, but these felt as if the person was there. So I don't really know what to call them. But I do know that when fiction writers or novelists are inside, or probably painters or any kind of artists, when they're inside the process of making their art, it's that kind of place. It feels that real. And as if you're in another world that's been created and you could step out of your regular life. I mean, if I could stay inside these novel worlds or creating art, I would.
Now, I know Joan of Arc is this revered figure today, still in France, and there are various statues and monuments dedicated to her honor. Have you gone to see them?
Oh, obsessively, are you kidding? I have actually licked the statue that's in Notre Dame. Nobody saw me. So, yeah, it's way beyond did I visit them.
Okay, so you have re-envisioned Joan of Arc, and you've set her into this near-future world. Who is the Joan in your story?
Well, you may have noticed I took God out. You know, minor character in the historical drama. When I did that, it wasn't for any kind of, you know, irreverent reason or anti-religion reason. I just rerouted the idea that she heard voices or that she heard the voice of God as a kind of more the voice of the planet and the voice of the cosmos, you know, in a Carl Sagan kind of way. And in that way, the wonder and the, you know, bigger than you and the creator kind of themes, I could retain them, but just kind of reroute them through what we know about science and the natural world.
So in your story, there's a big battle, kind of the last war on Earth, between Joan and her nemesis, this cult leader named Jean de Men. And it happens as life on the planet is crumbling. And you have a passage that describes some of this. Could you read that?
Sure. I remember what and where her first action was. Thousands of improvised explosive devices covering the tar sands in Alberta like malignant cancer cells invading a body. And I remember the last battle of the wars, her epic face-off with Jean de Men. In the face of a final battle sat the Alberta tar sands. She dropped to the dirt and rested there, face down, arms and legs spread. An army of resistance soldiers creating a sea of human protection around her for days. First, a series of violent solar storms occurred, one atop the other, and for a while everyone thought, my God, a natural disaster beyond imagination. And the skies wore clouds and colors we'd never seen before. And then the world's supervolcanoes, the enormous calderas at Yellowstone and Long Valley and Valles and North Sumatra's Lake Toba, Taupo, Era in Japan, erupted in chorus, almost as if by cosmic design. Tsunamis and hurricanes and typhoons followed as if in accompaniment. Ice caps speed melted. The waters rose, not gradually as they had been, swallowing up coasts and islands worldwide, but in a matter of weeks. In America, New York, and the upper and lower East Coast, Florida, gone, San Francisco, and most of California, drowned and sank Atlantis-like. Geocatastrophe. The sun's eye smote, organic processes like photosynthesis and ecosystems dead. The relation between Earth and its inhabitants dead. War dead. Earth reduced to a dirt clod floating in space. The atrocity of speed and destruction. The magnitude of those days still makes me hold my breath.
What was it like for you to imagine this this level of destruction and death?
Well, it was not jolly. I don't find those images and those narrative lines to be unimaginable. We're halfway, if not more, there. And so what a novelist can do if we're of any use to anybody, it's that we can enter the facts of our present tense and wade the waters of imagination to see what else is in there. I mean, we can go places that are too scary to go in regular life, and we can ask, well, okay, we see that the ice caps are melting. It is true. It is scientifically fact. But where do we take our imaginations from there? And so a novel can hold the horrible, you know, mm-hmm. in this space where the reader can enter, but you can still eat dinner and love your family afterward. And I think that's one of the powerful things about novels, is that it can suspend, you know, the unimaginable and play it out without killing anyone.
You know, I get the sense that art means everything to you. I mean, if there's one sort of redeeming quality of our species, it's our capacity to make art.
It is. For me personally, in that, like so many of us, I came from an abusive home and a set of circumstances that could have killed me. So as sappy as it sounds, for me, finding self-expression gave me the path away from self-destruction, although I tried self-destruction first many times as a, you know, young adult person. So, I mean, I got a tear in my eye when you said that. Art is everything to me, and I would say I believe in art the way I understand other people believe in God.
That's Lydia Yuknovich talking with Steve Paulson about her new novel, The Book of Joan.